Question. In what kind of marriage, to what kind of man, does a spouse conclude there is only a 99% chance her husband didn't do that? I'm almost certain the president is unfamiliar with the proverb, "The wicked flee when no man pursueth," because he just rolled on, unprompted, explaining why it couldn't possibly be true, ending by saying he was thinking of asking me to investigate the allegation to prove it was a lie. I said it was up to him. At the same time, I expressed the concern that such a thing would create a narrative that we were investigating him personally, and added that it was also very difficult to prove something never happened. He said I might be right, but repeatedly asked me to think about it, and said he would as well. One of his few questions, again seemingly out of nowhere, was to ask me how I compared Attorneys General Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch. I explained that Holder was much closer to President Obama, which had its advantages and its perils. I used the opportunity as an excuse to again explain why it was so important that the FBI and the Department of Justice be independent of the White House. I said it was a paradox. Throughout history, some presidents have decided that because problems come from justice, they should try to hold the department close. But blurring those boundaries ultimately makes the problems worse by undermining public trust in the institutions and their work. I got no sense he had any idea about or interest in what I was saying. Something else occurred to me about President Trump at that dinner that I found very instructive. I don't recall seeing him laugh, ever. Not during small talk before meetings, not in a conversation, not even here during an ostensibly relaxed dinner. Months later, the thought of a man whom I had never seen laugh stayed with me. I wondered if maybe others had noticed it, or if in thousands of hours of video coverage he had ever laughed. He had spent literally decades in front of video cameras, between his highly choreographed career as a business mogul and his years as a reality television star. So out of curiosity, I Googled it and looked through YouTube videos. In all of my searching, I found one video of something that could be called Donald Trump exhibiting a laugh, and a mean one at that. In January 2016, when he asked a New Hampshire audience about the origin of a noise in the background that sounded like a dog barking, and someone shouted, "It's Hillary!" There's a risk I'm overinterpreting this, and I suppose it's possible that in private he may keep his wife or children, or some favorite staff member in stitches, or that I may have missed a collection of his public laughs. But I don't know of another elected leader who doesn't laugh with some regularity in public. I suspect his apparent inability to do so is rooted in deep insecurity, his inability to be vulnerable or to risk himself by appreciating the humor of others, which on reflection is really very sad in a leader, and a little scary in a president. Near the end of our dinner, he asked another question, the first that was actually an effort to learn something about his guest. He wondered how I ended up as FBI director. In answering, I told him I had been pleasantly surprised that President Obama thought of the job as I did. He wanted competence and independence, and didn't want the FBI involved in policy, but wanted to sleep at night knowing the FBI was well run. I recounted our first discussion in the Oval Office together, which, even in that moment, occurred to me as the polar opposite of what was unfolding at this dinner. President Trump replied by saying he was happy I wanted to stay, because he had heard such great things about me from so many people, including his picks for Secretary of Defense and Attorney General. He then returned to the issue of loyalty, saying again, "I need loyalty." I paused again. "You will always get honesty from me," I said. He paused. "That's what I want. Honest loyalty," he said. This appeared to satisfy him as some sort of deal in which we were both winners. I paused. "You will get that from me," I said, desperate to end our awkward standoff, and telling myself that I had done a good enough job to make clear where I stood. In that moment, something else occurred to me. The leader of the free world, the self-described great business tycoon, didn't understand leadership. Ethical leaders never ask for loyalty. Those leading through fear, like a Cosa Nostra boss, require personal loyalty. Ethical leaders care deeply about those they lead and offer them honesty and decency, commitment, and their own sacrifice. They have a confidence that breeds humility. Ethical leaders know their own talent, but fear their own limitations, to understand and reason, to see the world as it is and not as they wish it to be. They speak the truth and know that making wise decisions requires people to tell them the truth. And to get that truth, they create an environment of high standards and deep consideration. Love is not too strong a word, that builds lasting bonds and makes extraordinary achievement possible. It would never occur to an ethical leader to ask for loyalty. After dessert, 2 scoops of ice cream for each of us, I went home and wrote a memo about the dinner, which quickly became my practice with President Trump after occasions when we spoke alone. I had never done something like that before in my conversations with other presidents, and didn't write memos as FBI director about encounters with any other person, but a number of factors made it seem prudent to do so with this president. For one, we were touching on topics that involved the FBI's responsibility and the president personally, and I was discussing those things with a person whose integrity I had come to seriously doubt after watching him campaign for president and since. I needed to protect the FBI and myself because I couldn't trust this person to tell the truth about our conversations. As was my practice, I printed 2 copies of the memo, one I shared with the FBI senior leadership team and then had my chief of staff keep in his files. The other I locked up at home for 2 reasons. I considered the memo my personal property like a diary, and I was concerned that having accurate recollections of conversations with this president might be important someday, which sadly turned out to be true. Chapter 14. The Cloud. If honor were profitable, everybody would be honorable. Thomas More. On February 8, 2017, Chief of Staff Reince Priebus invited me to the White House to meet with him in his office, a large room with a conference table and fireplace that offered a view of the grand Eisenhower Executive Office Building. This was the same room I had been in 13 years earlier with Vice President Dick Cheney to hear his view that thousands would die if the Justice Department didn't bend its view of lawful electronic surveillance. It was the same room I sat in near midnight later that same week in 2004, after the standoff at John Ashcroft's hospital bed. I was there now as a follow-up to my dinner with President Trump, and because Priebus wanted to understand, and I wanted to explain, the proper relationship between the FBI and the White House. Priebus had never worked in a presidential administration and seemed genuinely interested in getting it right. By that point, I'd interacted with 2 other White House chiefs of staff. My most memorable and contentious interaction was the race to the hospital against Andy Card,